Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Later today, the planet Venus will pass directly between the Sun and the Earth. It will appear as a tiny black dot crossing the surface of the Sun, but its importance to the study of astronomy is very great indeed. In 1769, this same event, which occurs twice each century, marked the first time that scientists used the transit to measure the dimensions of the solar system. Access to this knowledge was crucial to worldwide navigation at the time, when the oceans and seas represented a new age of exploration. Joining us now to talk about that is Mark Anderson. He's the author of The Day the World Discovered the Sun, an extraordinary story of scientific adventure and the race to track the transit of Venus. Welcome to the show, Mark Anderson.
Thank you, Ann.
To our listeners, we want to know if you're going to watch the transit of Venus this evening, where you're going to go and watch it, what are you going to do, and whether or not you saw it a few years back when it was here. What year was that, Mark Anderson?
2004.
So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Mark, they figured out that the transit of Venus provided the only way to get an accurate estimate of the distance between Earth and the Sun back in 1663, which was 98 years before the next transit. Why couldn't they do in 1663 what they tried to achieve in 1761 and eventually did 8 years after that?
Well, the Venus transit was the best way to triangulate the distance scales of the solar system. Everything in the sky appears to us as dots on a screen. So there's no immediate way of discovering how far away everything is, and this has always been a problem in astronomy. And so this is, in some sense, the most fundamental question in the exact science of that century. Astronomy was really the exact science of the age. So it was an important fundamental question, but you also teased a much more, as it were, down-to-earth question that astronomers were also solving at the time, which was navigation at sea. And that mattered to trade, it mattered to commerce, it mattered to militaries, it mattered to empire. So it was this incredible confluence of these great intellectual problems, these great scientific problems, and very practical problems for European nations that had great global aspirations.
Why couldn't they achieve that goal in 1663?
Well, people tried, but to measure these kind of distances in the solar system requires some sort of trick whereby you can essentially triangulate. And so the transit of Venus is this rare opportunity when you have something in the solar system, namely Venus, cross something that is very easily sort of a reference point. Mm-hmm. So if you time the planet's passage across the face of the Sun from different locations on the Earth, preferably as far apart as possible, which generally meant people went up to the Arctic and then down into the tropics. And then you compare those numbers, you're essentially making a big triangle with the base of that triangle being the distance between your observing stations. And then from that, with some trigonometry, you can figure out every distance, the distance to all the planets and the distance to the Sun.
My guest is Mark Anderson, science journalist and author. We're talking about his new book, The Day the World Discovered the Sun, an extraordinary story of scientific adventure and the race to track the transit of Venus. Later today, the planet Venus will pass directly between the Sun and the Earth. If you want to learn more about that, stay tuned. We're going to be talking about that with an OSU astronomer later on. This was an international project to determine the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and you compare it to more recent breakthroughs like the Human Genome Project and the Apollo program and things like that. Why?
Because this really was the first international big science project in human history. The first time that scientists, regardless of international or regardless of national borders, were able to collaborate in any kind of large scale sense on this fundamental question, fundamental scientific question, and so it became a worldwide race, a worldwide competition, and a worldwide collaboration.
Because I mean, they had to actually get together and agree who was going to go where, right?
Exactly.
There were spinoffs. I thought that was kind of an interesting aspect to all of this, the way you put it as spinoffs. Precision Timekeepers came out of this. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, the Reliable Calculations on Longitude.
Yeah. I mean, the way to look at it is the destination for each of these voyages to, I talk about three voyages in my book. Mm-hmm. One voyage up to the Arctic, above the Arctic Circle in this northernmost frontier town in Norway, and then a destination in Baja, Mexico, and then with Captain Cook journeying to Tahiti. All of these destinations allowed them to observe the Venus transit from these disparate, from these geographically diverse locations. But getting there involved, involved using all of the sort of the cutting edge navigational techniques. And it was the astronomers who had developed this, as it were, kind of a GPS system of the 18th century using the moon as the global positioning satellite, enabling you find the position, the exact position of the moon in the sky. You compare it with a reference book that was just being developed at the time, and that gave you Greenwich time. You compare Greenwich time to your local time, and you have your longitude. And in some ways, this really revolutionized navigation, and it really opened up the world in new ways. And the Venus transit voyages turned out to be this perfect testbed for these emerging tools of navigation.
Many, many astronomers, official, professional, I guess, or official and amateur, attempted to make these observations around the world on June 3rd, 1769. But you focus your book on three major expeditions, as you mentioned earlier. They traveled thousands of miles from home, and they set up shop thousands of miles away from each other. How did you narrow it to those three? I'm sure in the business, everybody knows this is painfully obvious, but to those of us not, why those three?
Well, ultimately, there were more than 100 observations that were reported back to London and Paris in the end of the June 3rd, 1769 Venus transit. But to make the story approachable and something that people can relate to with recognizable characters and stories that everyone can follow, I ended up picking out these sort of the top three voyages, the voyages that got the best results, the voyages that also, from a narrative point of view, were just had great characters and amazing adventures getting there and back.
So you follow the French astronomer Jean-Baptiste Chaptadoroche.
Mm-hmm.
He at first observed the transit in 1761 from Siberia, but it didn't work that time, or at least didn't provide the answers he hoped for. What went wrong that time?
Well, just by way of background, mm-hmm. Venus transits happen very rarely, about twice per century. When they do happen, they come in pairs, separated by 8 years. So in the 18th century, this meant that there was one in 1761 and then another one in 1769, and then that was it for more than a century. So the way it ended up working out was 1761, people kind of figured out how to do it right, and then 1769 was the real do-or-die moment.
So he crossed the Atlantic with Spanish partners. He traveled across Mexico, and he built this makeshift observatory. You actually start the book with him, I think,
That's
if I remember
correct.
Correctly,
yeah.
In San Jose del Cabo up in Baja California, what we think of as Baja California now. There was an epidemic there at the time, and he said, nope, we've got to build the observatory here, and we got to do it now.
Yeah. I mean, it really shows how crucial this was to these people who were really risking their lives, putting their lives on the line, and devoting no small part of their professional careers to this one observation. The Spanish and French explorers and scientists had every right to be, to be scared by this typhus epidemic, because as it turns out, many of them died before they could even, before they could even return.
Well, it makes it pretty amazing. He was gone for a long time, right?
Yes, he was. Yeah, months, many months.
And then in the Arctic, Denmark's King Christian VII invited two Hungarian priests, and I thought it was interesting that priests were doing this.
Yeah. I mean, there was a strong connection at that time between theology and science. It was, in fact, science wasn't even called science then. It was called natural philosophy. And it was seen as you know, getting to know the mind of the Creator and His creation. I even found an edition of the Bible from the early 1900s that said that glossed Genesis 1:1. You know, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It put a footnote on Genesis 1:1, and it said readers of this Bible will be interested to know that now we know the scale of the we know the size scale of the heavens and the earth, and thanks to the Venus transit we can we can spell that out for you. And then they proceed to elaborate this table with all the distances to the planets and the sun, deriving from the Venus transit observations. So it really was it was a scientific question, but it was much more than that too.
And yours, I guess, is the first ever English language account of that particular journey. You got it from the journals of his assistant, we should mention the priest Maximilian Hall and Johannes Szajnowicz.
Yeah, Hall and Szajnowicz. They were quite a pair. Fascinating characters who were invited by the King of Denmark to travel to this remote location that was predicted to be one of the best places on Earth to make the Venus transit observation, certainly from any Arctic location. And so they travel up there and face brutal ice storms in these horrendous, these horrendous traveling conditions just to get there. And but they collected amazing data and made it back. Their whole odyssey was recorded, although it was never translated into English before, and so we hired out a translation of their whole travel journals, and I got to really tell that in any detail for the first time in English.
What surprised you after, being able to read the journals the way you did?
Well, I think when I first read, there were little snippets of their accounts of their voyage that had been translated into English, mm-hmm. and I thought it was kind of hyperbole, when they were talking about all the these mountainous waves and these whiteouts and sailors practically the boat being practically turned into a skating rink and things like that. And I thought, well, they're probably exaggerating just for drama, but it really was no exaggeration. I mean, every day they faced these new perils. It was the kind of thing that you'd expect today to turn on the National Geographic Channel and see these people venturing up to Mount Everest or something like that. It was these extreme conditions and these extreme adventures, all for the sake of advancing the frontiers of human knowledge.
We're talking about the transit of Venus. It will occur tonight around 6 o'clock, or it'll begin tonight at about 6 o'clock. It'll be the last time in 100 years. So if you want to learn more about that, stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, fear of stall out in the world economy. We'll look at what comes next. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon from 1 until 2 on 89.7 NPR News. 62 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today, with a chance of showers mainly after 1 o'clock this afternoon. There's about a 40% chance of rain and a high of 69. Partly cloudy for tonight with still a chance of rain, a low of 53 degrees. Sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 73. Partly cloudy skies for Wednesday night, a low of 52. And be sure to visit WOSU.org/allsides. There's an archive which includes audio and video of every show. Explore the All Sides archive at WOSU.org/allsides. And the program continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the transit of Venus. It occurs tonight, begins at about 6 o'clock. For more information, you can go to a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Still with me is Mark Anderson. He's the author of a new book about the history of the science associated with the transit of Venus. The name of the book is The Day the World Discovered the Sun, an extraordinary story of scientific adventure and the race to track the transit of Venus. Once again, Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Also with us now is OSU Astronomy Professor Richard Poggi. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Thank you.
So before we move on, we should talk about, of course, the Captain Cook group. Maybe most familiar to most English-speaking people, perhaps, Mark?
Certainly. Yeah, Captain Cook really became Captain Cook because of the Venus transit. That is to say, he was a kind of an obscure lieutenant in the Royal Navy, and the Royal Society and the Admiralty called him up to head an expedition to this newly, quote-unquote, discovered island of Tahiti in the South Pacific with the intent of observing the Venus transit from there. So he assembled this scientific team, and they traveled halfway across the planet and collected some really extraordinary data, and it was quite a voyage. And it's said that Captain Cook ultimately wound up mapping more of the planet than any other human in history. And so Captain Cook returned to England, becoming the Captain Cook that we know him today, and was sent out on two other voyages, these sort of globe-spanning voyages of exploration. And so the Venus transit really launched his career.
It sounds like a nice thing to go to Tahiti for this. But they had to get around Cape Horn first, which made it almost as dangerous, if not more so, than what the others went through.
Yeah, they almost lost their entire science team as they rounded the Cape. Captain Cook had this notion that he could defeat scurvy, which was another major problem besieging all the voyages and expeditions across the planet of navies at the time and ships. Scurvy today we know is a vitamin C deficiency. They didn't know that at the time, but Cook had this insight that, you know, if we get fresh produce at every port of call, we can help keep our sailors healthy. Cook ended up being his first voyage, the Venus transit voyage, ended up becoming the first major voyage to not lose any sailors to scurvy, which was a major accomplishment and really a medical breakthrough. When they rounded the Cape, they sent their science team inland to collect some samples, and there was this snow squall that turned into practically a death march for some of the sailors with them. Fortunately, they built a shelter and just rode it out overnight. And so what started off as just a little couple hour journey inland became this overnight ordeal, and that was just one of many tremendous obstacles that this expedition faced.
The transport of their tools was excruciatingly as exciting as just about anything. It was very stressful because if they didn't have those in the end, they couldn't make the measurements.
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. When they got to Tahiti, they discovered that the villagers, the locals in Tahiti, placed great value on the metals that the Europeans brought with them, and not just precious metals, but things like iron and brass. And so, in fact, so much did they value the iron in particular that that they discovered that Tahitian women would trade anything, literally anything, for a nail, a hook from a hook that sailors use to keep their hammocks up. And in fact, the previous voyage to Tahiti, it almost fell apart in the harbor because so many sailors pulled nails out of out of their ship. Captain Cook knew this going in, and he put strict prohibitions on his sailors, regulating the commerce with the locals. Nevertheless, as backup, he kept about three extra barrels of nails.
No pulling the boat apart. Rick Poggi, I was thinking about this. How these people traveled just to the ends of the earth to do this, not really knowing if the weather was going to cooperate with them. And it's sort of shocking when you think about it. What if they showed up and it was snowing or raining or whatever? What then?
And that happened to a lot of these expeditions. Same thing we do even in the 21st century. I'll travel halfway around the world to an observatory and then watch it snow for 4 days.
And so that's just that.
It's what you do.
But when there's big events like this, it's very typical to have people watching from around the world, and they're still collecting data from this, right?
That's correct.
What are they going to use it for now?
Right now, it's part of it is just the astronomical spectacle. There's a subset of astronomers who are using this because we're using space satellites now to watch transits of other planets around their parent stars as a way to discover planets and even starting to find things that are getting close to the size of the Earth. So observing the Venus transit, where we have a great deal of detailed information close up because we've studied Venus, we've sent spacecraft there, we can look at what would that transit look like from a distant star, how well can we back out the properties of the planet Venus just from those kinds of observations, knowing what we know of the details close by.
And learning more about the distances in the universe.
Actually, we don't use it for measuring distances anymore.
Okay.
Radar pretty much obsoleted that technique in the 20th century.
It's just then the characteristics of the planets and that sort of thing.
Right. We learn about the characteristics of the planets, their size. In some cases, we can learn their mass, maybe even detect their atmospheres.
So to what extent is this an exciting thing for you to have this happen? You saw it in 2004.
Yes.
So
It's really cool to look at. You know, normally the face of the sun is pretty bland. There's a few sunspots every now and then. You have to use special filters to see any details like prominences or flares. But then to look at the sun and see a perfectly round, deep black spot crossing the face of the sun it's just really exciting. It's really fun to watch.
If I could jump in,
sure, Mark Anderson.
I wanted to add to Rick's point on this that not a lot of people have the experience of looking at the sun, you know, through a solar filter through a telescope with a solar filter, and it's important, of course, to stress: do not look directly at the sun.
Must have filter, right?
Without proper protection for your eyes. But I have to say, having taught a few astronomy classes myself, it's quite remarkable just to see the sun through a telescope, Venus transit aside, because when you look at it through the solar filter, a solar filter looks like a big piece of tinfoil that you put over the front of the telescope. It lets just a small percentage of the light through. And so the sky is black, and you've got this big disk right in the center, and it's like you're looking at a nighttime view of a star up close, and that is what it is, of course. That's what the sun is. But we never really have that experience in our day-to-day lives. You know, we've got this big shining thing that crosses the sky every day, and we don't really think twice about it. And, you know, it was one of the trick questions that I'd put in my Astronomy 100 quiz was, you know, name the closest star. And and very often, you know, you get people showing off, well, is it Proxima Centauri? Is it Alpha Centauri? And all this stuff. And a lot of times people would miss, you know, the obvious point. It's the sun. The sun is the closest star. And in some ways, just observing the sun through a solar filter really brings that home. And then all the more, as you're watching this other planet kind of crowd in front of it for this six-hour time frame, it really is, in some ways, you know, it really brings it home how we are another planet orbiting another star somewhere in the galaxy.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the transit of Venus. It occurs tonight. It starts at about 6 p.m. For more information, if you want to go online, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You just listened to Mark Anderson. He's author of The Day the World Discovered the Sun. And also Richard Pogge is with us. He's an OSU astronomy professor. Rick?
Yes.
June.
So, you know, one of the other things about watching the Venus transit is that when we look at the sky, we rarely, if ever, get a sense of depth, how distance is or the size of the solar system. And when you see Venus cross between us and the sun, and you realize that's a planet the size of the Earth between us and the sun, all of a sudden you get a sense of scale of the solar system.
When did they first discover this?
The first transit?
When was it first noticed?
The first transit was predicted by Johannes Kepler. In the year 1629, he predicted that in 1631 there would be a transit of Mercury and Venus across the face of the sun. He predicted when they would occur. They were first observed by Pierre Gassendi, a French astronomer working in Paris, who successfully observed the Mercury transit. But Kepler's calculation was off by 8 hours, and it turns out the transit of Venus was done before the sun rose in Paris, and Gassendi never saw it. Kepler thought that the second near transit of Venus in 1639 was going to be a miss. But a young British astronomer named Jeremiah Horrocks realized Kepler had made a mistake, and in 1639 corrected the calculation and realized the 1639 event would be an actual transit. contacted his friend William Crabtree, and the two of them made the first ever observation that we know of a Venus transit.
How were they able to observe it? What kind of filters did they use back then?
They used projection telescopes. They simply took the telescope, pointed it at the sun, and then projected the image on a white piece of paper.
Sort of like the cardboard box ones that they talk about now.
Except they used lenses and then relatively new telescopes. This was 1639. This is only 20 years after the first application of the telescope by Galileo.
It's really incredible too when you think about, you know, there have since the invention of the telescope, how many transits have there been? Seven? I mean, the Venus transits are so rare and so infrequent, you can count on two hands how many there have been. And in a sense, how many have been observed by humans since the dawn of time.
What's the magic, Rick Pogge, of 8 years? How does that work?
Well, it turns out that Earth and Venus circle the sun, but their orbits actually have a very close to whole number ratios. There are two whole number ratios that are important, 8 to 13 and 243 to 395. When you put that together, there's a repeating 243-year pattern in which you get a pair of Venus transits every 8 years with gaps of 121 and a half and 105 and a half years. And we happen to be in one of those 8-year periods. The next pair is going to happen 105 and a half years from now in the 22nd century.
An email from Kelly. She says, precisely what are we looking for and in what direction of the sky do we focus on? Well, I'm going to say I know what direction, toward the sun.
Right, right. But you don't want to look at the sun.
Right. So what are they looking for? What direction? Would it be east, you know, would it be left to right?
It'll be
right?
In the west.
It's the setting sun, so it's
okay.
The west.
So it's in the west, and the sun, depending on where you're standing, the Venus will be appearing, oh gosh, I'm trying to think where I'm standing, probably in the upper quadrant of the sun is where it appears, on the limb of the sun, shortly after 6 o'clock.
And it won't go straight across. It's going to kind of...
It's going to cut across a cord just mm-hmm. across the top of the sun. It takes about 6.5 hours to make a complete transit.
Chord being a geometric term?
Geometric term is basically not across the diameter, not across the center, but off to one side.
And Bradley on Facebook says, no clouds would be nice, but it is Ohio. So
there are, by the way, even if you get clouded out, I'm here in Massachusetts, and I was looking at the weather forecast today, and it doesn't look very promising. But even if you are clouded out, there are a number of webcasts and simulcasts that will be that you can view on the internet, and so you can see it as it happens.
Also want folks to know that Tom Burns, our wonderful friend Tom Burns from the Perkins Observatory, says that there are the special solar glasses available for $3 a pair, but only until 4 p.m. when he is leaving to observe the transit himself. So if you have time and you want to get over there, you can. We're going to talk about other options for you as well locally coming up in a little bit. But if you want to check that out, go to the Perkins Observatory website. We'll have a link to that at our website at WOSU.org. Yeah, Rick?
Well, it's also these glasses, I should say, are very special glasses. They're made of metal films, and they block out most of the light. It's extremely dangerous to look at the sun. I have to put my mommy voice on and say, mm-hmm. don't look at the bare sun with your naked eye. It does risk blindness. But also, sunglasses, welding glasses, darkened glass, unless it's a specialty material to block out sunlight, which includes the light we can't see, like infrared and ultraviolet, it's actually very dangerous. You can be looking at the sun through a dark piece of, like, welding glass that isn't properly infrared blocked, think you're protecting your eyes from visible light, but the infrared light's doing damage. So it's really important to, if you can't get one of these special eclipse glasses, either come down to a program where people are using professional solar filters, or the safest thing is to build a projection box with a little pinhole and just project the light. And that way you can see it safely, everyone around you can see it, and no one goes blind.
Okay, so I'm sure there are instructions for building one of those. I've seen them on the web before. James has a quick question. Can you make a homemade filter? And James, that's the answer. Yes, you can do it that way, but you can't make a homemade filter per se.
Not unless you had thin film metal technology available in your garage.
Okay, James, so no trying to do it yourself as far as making the filter.
But you can do a pinhole, right. or even if you take a binoculars without looking through them, you can use the optics to project it onto a screen behind you.
Right. Indirect viewing is the safest way to do this.
Exactly.
Mark Anderson, I was wondering, will there ever be any reason for someone to write a book about this transit of Venus, or was that sort of the last great story?
Well, as Rick has said, the current day transits are useful for the hunt for sort of sister Earths all across the galaxy, and in a sense, the Venus transit might be a chapter or a section of a chapter about the hunt for sister planets throughout the Milky Way, and that I think is a tremendous book because it's one of the great quests in science today for discovering these other planets all across the universe. Well, at least all across our galaxy. That's the place that we can see them.
And it's also interesting that the very first transit that was observed by Jeremiah Horrocks, he made very crude observations at the time. But he was able to come up with two important results. The first was to show that Venus was about the size of the Earth, which actually showed it was a twin planet to our own. And the second was he showed that the Sun had to be at least 50 million miles away.
Pretty impressive.
Very impressive when you consider it was done 6 years after the trial of Galileo.
And I would add, too, that the 1769 transit, the one where they got the best results, and you take the best data that these astronomers had collected, these scientists from up in the Arctic and down in the tropics. One, for instance, I quote one astronomer, Thomas Hornsby at Oxford University, in 1771, just 2 years after the transit. So this is after Captain Cook has returned and reported his data, and they've got some of the best data that they can find. He takes the best results and he puts it all together, and he prints this humble little chart. Here's the distances to the Sun and all the planets, and you compare that to what we know today. It's better than 99% accuracy. And it's really staggering when you think that, this was a time when the fastest that any person had ever gone was the speed of a fast horse, and the highest, the highest that anyone had climbed above the surface of the Earth was a cathedral spire. And yet, here people could inch out this measuring tape out into space and observe and measure these distances to greater than 99% accuracy. It's really staggering and quite beautiful.
Rick Polge, they had to build the observatories on the spot in these locations. What would one of those observatories have looked like?
It would look like a small amateur telescope, probably made of brass. Occasionally they would use a reflecting telescope, but primarily they were refracting telescopes. They would have a number of navigation instruments with them, sextants, clocks, pendulum clocks primarily for high precision. They would actually arrive at the site well in advance of the event and get very accurate measurements of their latitude and longitude. Those were essential for knowing where they were located on the Earth before they took the observations. They then took very accurate timings of how long it took Venus to cross through the entire track of the transit. So they watched when Venus was completely inside the limb of the Sun and when it exited. If you were at a slightly different location on the Earth, that timing would be different. Edmund Halley thought you could do it to about a second, but it turns out they could only measure that timing to about 10 seconds, and that's what limited the fundamental accuracy of the measurement.
Although I would add that there were some teams that ended up getting their best fix on where they were on Earth after the transit itself. In fact, it turns into quite a drama when the French and Spanish team and the Baja Peninsula are measuring the Venus transit. They get tremendous data. Meanwhile, all around them, people are literally dying left and right from this epidemic of typhus. They could have decamped right then and there and cut their losses. But the team sticks around because they know that there's going to be a lunar eclipse and they can get an even better fix on their position, because you need to get the to get the most meaningful results of a Venus transit observation. As Rick said, you not only need the timing of the duration of the transit, but you need to know exactly where on Earth your observatory is located. And I think they knew, the science team in Baja knew, that they could get a much better longitude and latitude fix if they did a precise measurement of the eclipse that was happening several days later. So they stuck around even after the Venus transit to get this, to get an even better result on their location on the planet. And it was, it was this dedication to an exact measurement that was proves ultimately so fatal.
Mark Anderson, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mark Anderson, he's a science journalist and author, and we've been talking about the transit of Venus. He wrote about it in his new book. It's called The Day the World Discovered the Sun, An Extraordinary Story of Scientific Adventure and the Race to Track the Transit of Venus. We're going to talk more about where you can see it and what you should do about that in central Ohio when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
The yoga exercise program on the Wii instructs users how to complete different poses. It's good exercise.
Lift your heels while you do this. Exhale, bend your knees.
Researchers at Ohio State and the University of Maryland are using the Wii to study concussion injuries.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
And stay right here with 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides begins, and it's Tech Tuesday. We'll discuss the growing use of Twitter and also preview the release of Windows 98 and talk about the latest gadgets. That's Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Noble on Long Condos, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring a diverse community with a mix of historic and newly built homes and condos. Details at homeportohio.org/nobleonlong.
WOSU Public Media presents the Chefs in the City online auction. You can bid now on fabulous culinary-themed packages. But hurry, the packages close each Thursday. All proceeds benefit children's educational programming on WOSU. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to view all items up for bid. Partly sunny skies today. There is a chance of afternoon rain, a high of 69. All Sides continues on 89.7.
We're talking about the transit of Venus. It begins tonight at about 6 o'clock. We're going to continue talking about it with Richard Pogge. He is an OSU astronomy professor, and they have a program at OSU today if you want to learn more about it. Rick's going to tell us about that, and we're also going to go into a little bit more detail about the transit and what you can expect to see. But first of all, let's reiterate the safety precautions.
Right, safety first. It's the sun is very bright. Even though Venus is crossing across the sun, there's still 99.99% of the light of the sun is coming through, so it's really not diminished in brightness at all. You need to use either a metal film, specialty, eclipse glasses. A projection device is the safest possible way, just a pinhole and a piece of cardboard with a white sheet of paper behind it, maybe a pair of binoculars held up and not looking through it, but just projecting against a wall.
Okay, so you just hold them up to the sun and let them project.
Hold the binoculars up and just from the side and then look at the projection on the wall.
Okay.
Or better yet, if you don't want to walk outside at all or it's cloudy, there are live feeds from NASA, the National Solar Observatory. Lots of places from clearer skies than Ohio will be watching this.
So the transit will look like, to those who have the right equipment, they'll be looking at a big red ball and a little black dot moving across it.
Right. Depending on the filter you use, if you use a proper solar filter for the telescope, what you would see is the sun would be a sort of a big yellow-orange ball, and there would be a perfectly velvet black spot about 1/30th the diameter of the sun that will enter from the northeast limb and slowly crawl across the surface of the sun.
There was an issue about sunspots or sun, if it comes anywhere near a sunspot, that's a must-see event as well. What are they talking about there?
Well, what would happen is the planet would actually cross between us and the spot on the surface of the sun. And what's interesting is, and then you get a combination of drop of the light as you cross not just simply the uniform face of the sun, but this black spot on the sun surface of the sun, these magnetic regions that are slightly cooler.
And it'll show that it's not as black as it looks once Venus crosses it, or would it blend together? Do we know?
I'm not sure, and I'm curious to see myself if we see one today.
Is there any way to know in advance whether that might happen?
There is. If I had a good picture of the sun, I could figure out from the track, but I haven't been able to find one.
Okay. And there's been references to the black drop effect. Can you tell us what that is?
Right. That was first observed actually by Captain Cook's expedition in 1769, What happens is the sun is being viewed through the Earth's atmosphere, and Venus together with it are going to be sort of turbulent. There's turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere, and it kind of smears things out. And your telescope optics aren't that good. So instead of seeing Venus as a perfectly sharp black spot that comes in the limb of the sun and then evenly, cleanly separates from the inside of the sun, there's sort of an optical effect that looks like a black drop of ink kind of oozing off the end, which is a combination of all this atmospheric turbulence. And what that does is it means it's not a clean entry and exit. It's sort of a slight ooze effect. You can see this if you bring your fingers together, holding at arm's length, and bring your fingers together. Your fingers appear to your eye to touch before the fingers actually touch. And that's just simply an optics effect.
Also, they say that the best times to view this and is during the ingress and the egress. In other words, when it enters the range of the sun and when it leaves it. Why is that?
That's when most of the real action happens. You can actually see the motion and see the changes. It takes about 17 and a half minutes from the point that Venus just makes contact with the sun's limb until it's entirely inside the face of the sun. Once it's in the face of the sun, you don't sense the motion as much because it takes 6.5 hours to cross, and so you lose your references.
Mm-hmm. And from where we're sitting in central Ohio, we'll be able to clearly, assuming there's no clouds, see the ingress, but we're not going to be able to see the egress.
That's correct. The entire transit takes 6.5 hours. Unfortunately for us, it starts about 2.5 hours before sunset. So we'll see first contact when Venus just touches the outside at about 6:04 our time. It'll be fully inside the sun a little after 6:22. And then the sun sets a little bit before 9 o'clock.
So there is some time, though.
Oh, we get about 2.5 hours.
Which is pretty good. And you said Hawaii, you can see the whole kit and caboodle.
Westward into Hawaii, Australia, most of Eastern Asia are going to get the best view.
What about folks who do want to see it? They can watch it online. They can, if they have the proper solar glasses, they can use those. They can do projection if they want, but you also have some opportunities for the public to view it at OSU. Tell us about that.
Right, Ohio State today is going to have a Venus transit event starting at 5 o'clock in the evening. We'll start at 5 o'clock in McPherson Laboratory, room 2015. There'll be a public lecture on measuring the distance of the sun using Venus transits from the beginning to the present day and the relevance for science. At 6 o'clock, we have special telescopes set up on the roof of Smith Laboratory, where we normally have our nighttime telescopes. These will be equipped with professional solar filters. They'll be operated by professional astronomers, so it'll be a very safe viewing experience, and we invite the public to join us. We'll continue observing until about 8:30. We'll have a reprise of that public talk downstairs in Smith Laboratory. And then when the sun finally sets, if it's clear, we'll take out our nighttime telescopes and continue observing. Mars and Saturn are visible tonight and star clusters. And we'll continue observing from about 9 to 11 o'clock.
My guest is Rick Poggi. He's an OSU astronomy professor. We're talking about the transit of Venus. If you have a question or comment for Rick, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rick, it's not easy to get these glasses right now, right?
It's really hard. I haven't been able to get a pair myself.
Except apparently they do still have some at the Perkins Observatory. They're charging $3 a pair, but they're only going to be available until 4 p.m. because Tom Burns, our good friend Tom Burns from Perkins Observatory, is going to be checking out to observe the transit himself. So why don't you give him a call there before you go to make sure that they have them if that's what you want to do. All right, so if folks are going to come to OSU, do they need to make a reservation or can they just show up?
No, they can just show up. We'll be open to the public for starting at 5 o'clock.
How much public interest has there been in this from where you sit?
Quite a bit. The 2004 transit got a little bit of interest, probably because it started at 6 o'clock in the morning. We got to see the last 2 hours of the transit 8 years ago. So it was hard to hold a program that started at 6 a.m. during finals week. But this year, a combination of factors has come into play. One of them is that the Kepler space mission has been discovering planets around other stars using a transit method, watching those planets pass between us and the star, causing their light to dim a tiny amount. To date, they've got more than 200 confirmed planets around other stars with about 2,000 more candidates. Some of those planets are starting to get down to the size of the planet Earth. So there's a tremendous interest in transits as a way to discover planets. And also, with the 400th anniversary of Galileo's telescope in the years 2009 and 2010, there was a large international movement to open up the public outreach of the nighttime sky. We started doing that at Ohio State. We said, well, we'll hold a star party at night and for this international star party, see how many people showed up. And 400 people showed up with very little advertising. We realized it was a huge interest in the central Ohio community, so we began to expand our efforts at Ohio State to bring the sky to the public.
Discovering all these planets really has been pretty exciting. It seems to get capture a lot of people's imagination.
It's been immensely exciting. When 12 years ago, when I started teaching introductory astronomy, we'd have one solar system we know of, our own. We now know of more than 600 solar systems around nearby stars.
That's pretty cool.
That's amazing. we haven't quite found the Earth, another Earths yet, but we're getting really close. I think probably in the next decade, we may find the real goal is to find an Earth in the habitable zone of its parent star.
There is a movie named Another Earth, however. It just came out. Once again, if they are going to watch it, it's not going to go across from one end of the sun to the other. It's going to cut off a corner of it, arc of it, I should say.
Right. We're going to see it enter from the northeast and exit kind of to the northwest, if you could see the entire transit, say, from Hawaii or New Zealand.
And those who can have been encouraged to precisely time the contact points and submit that to organizations collecting data from around the world. They apparently want to recreate the experiments from the 18th and 19th centuries. First of all, if you're going to time it, how would you do that? How would you recommend people do that?
Well, you would have had to start a few months ago getting practice with a telescope.
Well, then forget about it.
And other clocks. You would need an extremely accurate atomic clock. You would need to get yourself set up with a telescope and have practiced in doing it. I've done timing observations like this. They're actually pretty tricky to get well to do right.
And why would you want to recreate those experiments? Is there something we can learn from that?
It's mostly the historical interest, as well as seeing if perhaps more data from many different sites can perhaps use statistics to improve the measurement. You're never going to get a refined measurement better than we get with radar.
Do we learn anything about Venus in this process?
Not really. We've already sent spacecraft into the atmosphere and landed them on the surface. We have orbiters around the planet. We've probed the surface with radar. We're not going to learn a whole lot about the planet itself. It's mostly that it's going to act as a reference point, a well-known reference point, for understanding how to read the signals that we're getting from transits around other stars, where we don't see anything close to this kind of detail.
And no one alive today, all things being equal, is going to be alive for the next one.
The next one is going to occur in the year 2117 in December. If you're ancestors or descendants are living in Columbus, Ohio, they won't even see that one at all. They'll have to wait for the second transit of the pair in 2125 December to be able to see it. And I'm not planning to be 164 years old, so I'm not going to be around for it.
Who'd even want to be 164 years old? But why June and December? Is there something going on?
Well, it's because of the commensurate orbits. Actually, there's a half year in there. It's not 121. It's 121 and a half and 105 and a half. So they alternate between these two. So it alternates between December and June. It's just how it happens to land in the calendar.
So 8 years ago, it was
in June.
In June. And next time
around, it'll be December.
Okay.
In 1882 and 1879, it was December. During the 1761-69, it was June. And the 1639 were in their times, alternating back and forth.
You've studied the previous those expeditions that we were talking about earlier with Mark Anderson and his book. What fascinated you most about those? What struck you?
Well, it was the tremendous dedication of the astronomers to this. Mark mentioned, for example, the Chapdelaine de Roche, in fact, not only risked his life, but lost his life staying around to measure the lunar eclipse to get the best possible position. A French astronomer, Le Gentil, spent 11 years away from home, and they thought he was dead and looted his estate when he got back to Paris. And he spent 11 years and didn't actually get to make good measurements of the transit because of bad weather in Pondicherry the second time, and because he was at sea during the first transit, because British forces had captured Pondicherry and the ship he was on couldn't land.
But the world was at war.
The world was at war. The first transit occurred 6 years into the Seven-Year War. And they actually the astronomers carried with them letters of passage from their governments allowing them to cross military lines to be able to go to their observing stations. So this is the First World War, the 7 Years' War. It determined most of the rest of the course of European history. In fact, the 7 Years' War was known in North America as the French and Indian War, and Parliament's ham-fisted attempts to pay for the debts accrued during that led to the taxation policies that led to the American Revolution. So this was a war that determined most of subsequent history in the world and really upset the global power. And yet, during the height of that bitter war, scientists were allowed to cross lines to go to their sites. However, having a letter of transit is only good if you can present the letter of transit
before
and long-range
your
naval gunnery kind of prevented that from happening on a couple of occasions.
It was really typical to have scientists on those ships, though, often, wasn't it?
It was. In fact, the first transit that was attempted to measure the distance of the sun was a Mercury transit observed by Edmund Halley. He had gone to St. Helena, and the Royal Navy had put him in charge of the expedition. What came out of that was good measurements of the Mercury transit. Halley got the idea of using Venus transits and organized the 1761 expeditions that he didn't live to see. It also taught the Royal Navy, one, it was good to have naturalists on board. Two, it was a bad thing to have naturalists in command. That's why when Cook went out, it was a Navy lieutenant, Cook, who was in charge, but Nathaniel Green was the Green was the astronomer.
Is there anything else like this coming up? You mentioned the Mercury transit.
Yes, Mercury transits happen a lot more often. Okay. They happen in 7, 13, and 33-year cycles. So the next Mercury transit will be in 2016 in May, and it will be completely visible from Columbus. And then one will follow that in 2019.
And then eclipses, just no big deal anymore?
Oh, no, eclipses are a great big deal. They're lots of fun to watch.
But it's a lot of fun now.
It is a lot of fun. Although, interesting that we're talking about traveling long distances. I have some friends who go to see total solar eclipses. I've never seen one. They will go to places like Siberia, the ends of Asia. They go to some pretty adventurous places to see these.
So there's still a lot of wonder involved in it.
A lot of wonder. The universe is just a wonderful place to view. And when you can think about looking at a transit of Venus, it's something that no one's going to see on the Earth for another 105 years. And yet people went so much out of their way to measure this because it told us the size of the universe.
Well, Rick Pogge, thanks again for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Rick Pogge, he is an OSU astronomy professor. The OSU Astronomy Department has a program for the public tonight. If you want to learn more about that, we'll have a link at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll also have a link to the Perkins Observatory if you're interested in going up and getting one of the solar glasses, which are absolutely imperative if you're going to look at it with the naked eye. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.